Hello, I'm Ross Carriage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs, of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science. And my guest today, Dr. Mike Smiley, is literally going to take us to the ends of the earth. Mike, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Hi there, I'm Michael Smiley. I'm a medical oncologist in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. I started work here in 1994 after doing my training in Ottawa. And then I spent most of my career doing melanoma and lung cancer, breast cancer. And then as I got closer to retirement, I decided that I would branch out a little bit, and I gave up melanoma and lung cancer. And I took over care of the patients from the Northwest Territories, which is a large territory bigger than most of the provinces. And it encompasses a massive area, but only a population of about 50,000 people. So most of the people have to come from quite far distances. And I fly up to Yellowknife, which is the capital city of the Northwest Territories. And patients will fly in from Nunavut or the Northwest Territories, from small communities along the Arctic Ocean, into Yellowknife to see for their consult or follow-up visits. So I've been doing that for about 2 years, but I actually started doing Yellowknife about 1998. And at that time, all the Northwest Territories patients used to travel to Edmonton for their treatment. And then about that time, they decided that they would set up a peripheral chemotherapy clinic in Yellowknife. And so the internist came down to do a two-week rotation with us. And I, at the time, had a breast cancer patient from Northwest Territories. And I told her I'd always wanted to go up there to go fishing. And so she brought me all this fishing stuff. And then I planned my fishing trip. And then I talked to the internist before I left. I said, do you want me to give a talk to the chemotherapy unit? I'm up there. And they said, well, if you're going to come up there, you may as well do our clinic. And that's how the clinics all started. And so there's three of us originally that would rotate. We'd go once every 3 months, and we'd go up for a day, see the cancer patients, then fly back that night. And then it didn't seem to work very well because we didn't have access to their records. So eventually they transitioned, and they actually created a 1.0 position for an oncologist to cover the Northwest Territories about 2 years ago. And that's when I took over being the sole oncologist for the Northwest Territories. And now I have access to the charts, so I can see things in real time, what's happening to patients. I can look at all their investigations. I can look at their CT scans. It seems to be going quite well. There are challenges, but I think the rewards are much greater than the challenges. And the other thing I'm probably best known around here is I have also the father of five kids. And for most of that time, I was a single dad raising five kids and three girls and two boys. And I quickly learned the differences between boys and girls. And one big difference is that typically when girls turn 18 or 19 and they go to school, they move out of the house, but boys don't seem to ever move out. One was 30 when he moved out, and the last one, I'm still living at home. People ask me when my boys are going to move out, and I just say, why would they? Because it's free at home and they don't have to pay for anything. So it was a challenge, and I think there's ups and downs. And 2015, I had my own cancer diagnosis, so I had to go through surgery and then 6 months of chemotherapy. And then in 2020, after I was discharged from the clinic, I decided that I was going to do something on my bucket list, and I was going to go to Africa and do Mount Kilimanjaro. I was supposed to do it with one of my daughters, but she, I was going to say unfortunately, she got accepted into her PhD program, but that was good news for her. So she had to bail at the last minute. So I went with her friend, and we did Kilimanjaro. It was 6 days up, 2 days down, and it was really a life-changing experience to go to Africa and just go up. You go through six different climatic zones. So you start at tropical and you end up at Arctic, which I'm pretty much at home with, coming from Edmonton. But you get up there and the altitude is difficult to deal with. So you're over 19,000 feet. And so you do get hypoxia, and I did have some altitude sickness, but overall tolerated it well because we went up fairly slow. And then 2 days back down, and we did a week-long safari in the Serengeti, and then back to Canada and back to work. So it was quite an amazing experience.
Mike, there is a lot to unpack in that opening statement. So actually, let me do the first thing because I didn't know about this. Tell me about your cancer diagnosis. What kind of cancer?
So in 2014, I was started developing after I did a grand. I'm a big cyclist, and so after doing the Grand Fondo in Banff, I built this very non-specific pain in my left lower quadrant, and this wasn't going away. And then, of course, as a physician, you ignore your symptoms. I kept thinking it was a hernia or something I'd done when I did the Grand Fondo. So after about 4 months, I casually mentioned it to one of my surgical friends, And he just picked up the phone, said, call my office, book your colonoscopy. And then so I could book my colonoscopy. That was found to have a cancer in my sigmoid colon. And so they, so then about 2 weeks later, I had my surgery. And it was stage 3B. So obviously they recommended Opox chemotherapy. And it was, wasn't keen on the oxaliplatin, but I guess it was, you know, 50-50 without anything and 65-35 if I took the chemo. So I took the chemotherapy, which was, I think I did most of it, but I did bail a little bit early from it. So after I got that, and then every three months, of course, you get your CAs and yearly you get your CT scan. So it's a bit of a, I understand the anxiety that patients have a little bit, you know, when they have their CT scans or tests, there's always that level of anxiety because you wake up and say, you know, you've got your appointment coming up and say, you know, my life could change dramatically by tomorrow. But when my oncologist is actually a resident of mine. And so he was good whenever I had my tests or anything. He always showed up my office during the same day and just went over the scan results, went over to CDA. So everything has remained well. And I'm out almost 10 years. So I'll be 10 years in 2025.
Wow. I mean, when you went through the chemotherapy, was it in the same infusion center that you send your patients to?
Yes, it was. But they were good. I continued to work during my treatment. I went down to 4 days a week, though, from five. But the nurses were really great. They stuck me in that little back corner and pulled the curtains across so nobody would see me. But I did have some patients see me. And so I think it was a shock to them. And they, of course, would mention it in clinic that they saw me there. And
did you sort of deny it? Were you open with it? How did you deal with it?
I kept it pretty much to myself. I didn't tell my patients really. But I have to tell you a funny story. I have one patient who's one of my melanoma patients who I was seeing in follow-up. And she actually had a brain metastasis. And she's out 10 years. And I was seeing her in follow-up back then. And I walked in. And I'd lost maybe 20 pounds after surgery. And I walked in and I said hello to her. And I said, how are you doing? And she just looked at me and says, Dr. Smiley, what's wrong with you? And I said, nothing. She goes, no, what's wrong with you? And I said, nothing. She goes, you look like shit. What's wrong? What's wrong?
I love how you build these relationships.
I pretty much like told her, and I've been looking after her for 5 years. And she said, you know, I was more like a family member to her than a doctor. So she's quite concerned. And then, so then I told her I was going through chemo. I just had surgery. I was going through chemotherapy. So, yeah, so that's the only patient I really told. But she wasn't going to let me not tell her, so.
Yeah, exactly. She was like, she wasn't going to take no for an answer. And you're back to cycling because I recall that we had to postpone this podcast because you fell off your bicycle and broke your wrist. Is that right?
My elbow, yeah. So I just, I've been a long-term cyclist and I tend to go a little bit fast and a little bit, I'm not too careful. And so I was just coming over the cross and I was just there was a bunch of traffic. So I thought I'd just go up the sidewalk, bypass the traffic. And I was just looking and there's a pedestrian on there. So I just went to ring my bell to let her know I was coming. The minute I went to turn my bike tire, I just was at a slightly wrong angle. And rather than go up the it was only a 1-inch rise, but instead of going up, I just caught the tire and flipped my bike over in the side. And so I went down hard on my elbow and shattered my olecranon. So I was in hospital for a couple of days and then got surgery. I have 3 plates and a bunch of screws. And so I'm slowly getting mobility back in my right arm, but he said no cycling for 6 weeks. And I'm up to 4 weeks now, but I think in 2 weeks, I'll be able to get back on my bike and start to cycle again.
Have you had accidents on the bike before? Or is that the first big one?
This is the first big one. And I think that I've fallen a few times before. Sometimes it's when I cycle in the wintertime, I hit an ice patch or something go over, but I've never gone over that hard. And this was just, I think it was just the way I caught my wheel and just the way I went down.
Do you think it's going to affect your confidence for going fast? And
I'm going to get rid of my clip-in pedals for the city. I think that's just dumb because I think that with your clip-in pedals, you can't get your feet out as quickly. And I think had I not been clipped in, I think I would have been able to get my foot out and broken the fall a little bit. So
it's funny because when I speak to cyclists, it's not if you've had an accident, it's when are you going to have one?
Yeah.
And the thing is, it becomes more attractive as we get older and our bones get more fragile. Yeah. And so it is kind of an accident kind of waiting to happen. But anyway, let's go back to you because you're clearly a super active guy. Okay, I still want to go into the idea of this evolution of how you become an oncologist and you end up looking after just this enormous landmass. I did a rough calculation. So Northwestern Territory, plus I believe you cover the western side of Nunavut.
Yeah.
So I calculated that the two together is about a quarter of the landmass of the continental United States. I mean, it's enormous.
Yes.
It's like 1 million square miles if you add the two together, or maybe like 800,000 square miles. And the total population of those two areas, again, just to put it into context, what is the population that covers?
42,000 people in Northwest Territories, and there's that old 40,000 in Nunavut, but we only service the western part of Nunavut. So the part of Nunavut that we service wherever the planes fly to. So the eastern Nunavut, the planes typically fly to Ottawa, so Ottawa looks after those patients. And then the ones in the western Nunavut fly to Yellowknife, so I look after those patients. So it's probably about 50,000 people in total.
Yeah, 50,000 people over, 800,000-900,000 square miles. Just mind-blowing. How does Edmonton end up the place that's responsible for those territories? Is that a kind of political, they hash it out, or is it just because it's... Is that driven by Edmonton, or is that driven by the government?
Driven by both. I think that the commonest lights are between Yellowknife and Edmonton, and Edmonton's kind of the service center for the Northwest Territories. So I think, with Yellowknife has a population of 20,000 people, and they're not going to have specialists. There's only one general surgeon there full time. There's an orthopedic surgeon. There is no internist anymore. So all the physicians that go up there are traveling locums. A lot of them go up there because they like to go up there, like myself. And so Edmonton has signed an agreement with the Northwest Territories that they will be responsible for supplying specialist services. For the gastroenterology, invasive procedures, they all travel down to Edmonton to get it. And so it's just part of our ongoing commitment that we supply services to the Northwest Territories.
And then are the GPs up there?
We have GPs, yeah. So the GPs are all salary and they rotate. So some of the GPs work as GPOs. They rotate week on.
Can you explain what a GPO is?
A GPO is a GP oncologist. So they're not a fully trained GP oncologist. Like they're family medicine doctors who do a short rotation in medical oncology, either 2 weeks to 2 months, just to learn some of the basics of chemotherapy. And they will do the assessments. So when the patients come for their three-weekly treatment, they check their blood counts, they do an assessment of the patient, and then they can order their chemotherapy. I order the chemotherapy initially online, and they just sort of follow my protocol. But if there's any concerns, then I just have to be available at all times just for a phone call to answer any questions.
And you didn't grow up there. You grew up in Canada, obviously, but whereabouts in Canada?
So I was born in Saskatchewan, which is the next province over from Alberta. And then when I was about six, my family moved to Ottawa for two years. Then we moved from there to Brockville, which is a small town between Kingston and between Montreal, Toronto. It's just on the St. Lawrence River, so right on the U.S. border.
What did your parents do for a living? Let's start there.
My mother was a nurse and my dad was a physician. He graduated from Queen's University in Kingston in 1949. And then his brother was working as a family doctor in a small town in Imperial. So he asked my dad to go out. He was moving on to Vancouver. And he asked my dad to come out for a year to do his take over his practice till he found somebody permanently. And at that time, my dad was in his second year of surgical residency. And he decided that, with two kids, he would take a bit of a break and a bit of money, then go back and finish the surgery. And he was planning to stay for a year, but he stayed for 7 years. And he eventually went back to Ottawa, finished up his surgical residency, then did urology. And then he was going to move to Alberta. And then I think he's just driving to Kingston and he drove through this small little town on the St. Lawrence River that he thought was beautiful. So on his way back, he stopped to see if they needed a urologist. And fortuitously, the chief of staff said, actually, we just had a Department of Medicine meeting. We decided to advertise for urologists. So that's how I started there.
That's perfect. So did you go through a period of time when you thought about not being a doctor? I mean, there's a lot of medicine in the family there.
So as a young kid, I had an uncle that I idolized. And he was a farmer, and I always wanted to be a wheat farmer, a grain farmer like him. And then I realized as I got older, it probably wasn't the smartest thing. Then I went off to do biochemistry, and then I got a job with a pharmaceutical company, and then subsequently a medical diagnostics company. I did that for a couple of years, and then I went back to medical school with the dream initially of becoming a pathologist. And because I wanted to work with the labs I like the study of pathology. And
so I think the undergraduate degree and was it a radio diagnostics company, I think you told me.
It was a radio diagnostics company, yes.
But medical school, you decided to go somewhere else. You went to my home country.
Yeah, so I was applying to medical schools, and then one of my mother's friends, who was an internist, she had graduated from England, and one of her classmates was in Leicester, and she'd been over to visit, and they just had built this brand new medical school in Leicester, and so she said it was just beautiful, you should apply here. And so I applied there, and I applied to two places in Ontario, and then about 2 months after I applied, I got a invitation to go over to England for an interview. And I've never been to Europe before. And so I think just when you first go there, you're overwhelmed. And I thought it would be so much fun to go over there. And at that time, there was full reciprocity between Canada and the UK. So I went over and spent 5 years there in medical school, 5 years. And I did 5 years in medical school. And then I did my house job. And I came back to Canada to do my internal medicine.
And pathology still stayed in your mind? Or when did that go away?
I really like pathology. I love the study of pathology, but I didn't like the actual practice of pathology. So I found that I didn't like the autopsies very much, or being down in the, you know, getting surgical specimens. I liked more the theory of pathology. And then one hematologist in Leicester, who I got quite close with, said, well, you should do hematology, because he said half it's pathology, the other half is clinical medicine. I did enjoy clinical medicine. And then I switched to oncology because hematology, I didn't like the blood coagulation as much. I liked more of the tumors. And so I thought if I did hematology, I could still do lymphomas or solid tumors. And so that's why I switched to oncology.
And then you did your oncology training where?
In Ottawa.
Okay. And out of that, I think we said you then ended up a kind of melanoma specialist. Were you always planning to be a generalist with an interest, or were you planning to be a kind of academic melanoma doctor initially?
I'm planning to be an academic. And I think that when I left Ottawa, one of my mentors in Ottawa, who was, we all idolized because he lived and breathed oncology, and he ran the phase one program then in MD Anderson for quite some time, and then came back to Ottawa to be the program director. And he said, always take a tumor that has no effective treatments, because the only way you can go is up. And he said, you can build your own little niche there. So when I came to Edmonton, I actually did several tumor sites. I did a breast cancer, GI cancer, trunk, melanoma, and sarcoma. But back then, there wasn't a lot of effective treatments. So it's ironic that even though I had several tumor sites, I wasn't as busy as I am. Then as we got busier, we got more treatments. I started giving up sites, and then I eventually gave up breast cancer and then specialized in lung and melanoma. But melanoma was always my passion.
Roughly what years are we talking about here? So when did you become a full-on attending in Edmonton?
Started full-time in 1994.
Okay.
In Edmonton. And at that time we used chemotherapy. The regimen was called the Dartmouth regimen. So it was a four-drug regimen. It's based on a phase 2 study out of the U.S. and showing response rates of about 55%. But as the phase 3 studies came out, the response rates consistently dropped. Then there was a study, the intergroup study, looked at Dartmouth versus DTIC. And there's a higher response rate for the 4-drug regimen, but survival was exactly the same. There was a lot more toxicity with 4 drugs. The recommendation was only use the 1 drug. I always remember that ASCO presentation, somebody asked the question, well, is dacarbazine any better than a placebo? And the whole room went silent. And the answer is probably no. And then in 2008, Ed Korn did a well-known meta-analysis and showed that the median survival for melanoma patients with stage 4 disease was 6.2 months, and that I hadn't changed for 50 years.
Wow.
So at that time, I was the site leader for Melanoma Canada. So I went down to Bethesda as part of the State of the Science meeting. At that time was when I first became familiar with these checkpoint inhibitors. And we had this CTLA-4 drug out at that time. So a small company called Medarex had it in trials. And so it was nice because I was able to see those Medarex trials. We participated in them. I was able to see them through fruition. And then the PD-1 inhibitors came out. And then, of course, the combination studies. So the prognosis of melanomas changed dramatically from 2010, really, to 2000. 15 with huge advances.
Yeah, I was friendly with one of the melanoma doctors here, and I used to say, well, what works? Because as you said, you know, there are lots of things which probably were debatable value. And he said resection. And that was kind of like, if you didn't get it when you're with the dermatologist, you're in kind of deep trouble.
Yeah. I remember Donald Morton telling us one time in a meeting that the cure for melanoma is surgery, 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 and more surgery.
Yeah, exactly. And then now, like you say, it's transformative. And, you know, the most famous one is the U.S. ex-president Jimmy Carter, who is unbelievably still alive with his stage 4 melanoma. And he's also about 100.
Yeah.
So amazing on two different levels. Let's flesh this out a little bit. So we're in the mid-1990s. You're working on all this. So when did the five kids arrive?
So I had two in Saskatchewan when I was doing my residency, and then two in Ottawa when I was there. And then when I moved back to Edmonton, one was born about 5 years later. He was kind of an afterthought. And so he was 5 years younger than my youngest. So
what was the spread in age?
So they're all pretty close. The two girls were a year and a half apart, the two oldest ones. And then the third one was about 2 years after that. And the fourth one was about a year and a half after that. And then it was 5 years through our last one.
Wow. And then when did you, you know, with all sensitivity, when did you become a single dad?
Came a single dad around 2006, 2007.
And you shared custody of the children or?
Shared custody, yeah.
Yeah. Was your ex-wife still geographically close?
Yeah, but she didn't really have any contact with the kids and she had issues and stuff. And I think she just didn't have contact with the kids. And the kids, I think sometimes initially they tried to make contact and then they decided not to. So I left it up with them what they would, you know, I said it was their decision what they wanted to do.
Well, how old was the youngest and the oldest at that time?
So the youngest was, I think he was 8 at that time. And yeah, he would have been, yeah, 7 or 8. And he was the one that was most affected by it, I think. But he kind of became very close to me. And I think over the years, he's grown up. And it's kind of like cute now because he's a huge hockey fan. And I have season tickets. And he gave me the season tickets one night. It was about 2 years ago to go to Scranton. And I asked him how he enjoyed the game. And he goes, well, it was good. But he said, to be honest, I like going with you better. And I said, is that because I pay for everything? And he said, you're kind of my best friend. And I said, Michael, you have to get out more.
That is an adorable thing to say.
Yeah. I mean, he told me he's looking for a house with his girlfriend right now and asked him where he wanted to live. And he says, well, I really don't want to live any more than 5 minutes away from you. So I thought that was kind of cute. So
that is the sign of, you know, at the end of it, you did a good job.
Yeah. And I subsequently remarried 2 years ago and he's got a really good relationship with my present wife's.
You're working full time. You've got five kids. At what point do you start flying up north? And what do you do with five kids when you just disappear off for a while?
Well, I think that's one of the major reasons why I gave it up. And early on, I was only going up once every 3 months. But I gave it up for a long time when the kids were younger. And then I started going back about 3 years ago. When I started going back, the kids were like, Michael was 22, so it's easy to leave him at home now. And he's the only one at home and he's got a puppy so he can look after the dog.
And when you go up now that you're a quote unquote, you know, 1.0 FTE for this job, how long do you spend up there?
So it's variable. It's kind of been growing. So from the time we started the inception of the program, it was 1 day a month. Then it went to 2 days. Now it's 2.5 days. Now it's 3 days, and sometimes we have to spread it out to 3.5 days. And I did go up last month for an extra clinic because my one daughter got married in Italy. And so when I was away for the week, we had like 6 new consults. And I got back from Italy. I went to Yellowknife 2 days later, and we didn't have any spots for the new consults. So I came up 2 weeks later, so just did 2 days of clinic and caught up on all the new consults and some of the follow-ups. But now it's about 3 days mostly, but it can space out to 3.5 days. I usually fly up Tuesday night and take the late Air Canada flight up. And then I fly back Friday night. I get back around 9 o'clock at night usually.
I'm trying to get my head around who exactly are the patients there. So can you describe the population? And obviously there's the people who live in Yellowknife and then the people who are sort of coming to Yellow Heart to see you?
It's a very different population. The demographics are very different. So Yellowknife is the capital city. It's a lot of the service industry, like the mining industry sector, service for the mines, like government workers. And then the other half of the patients come from mostly indigenous communities from around Yellowknife or else high up into the Arctic. So there's several communities around Slave Lake that we deal with. And then there's going up the Mackenzie River. There's a lot of communities on the Mackenzie River that flows all the way up into the Arctic Ocean. Then Inuvik is on the Delta. And then there's, they're mostly from the Dene Nation. And then the people along the Arctic and Nunavut are typically Inuit or Inuk. And so they have a different lifestyle, again, from the Dene indigenous people. So the Dene indigenous, their traditional food is a lot of moose, sometimes some caribou, lots of fish. The Inuit, they do get a fair amount of caribou, so occasional polar bears, and then they get fish, Arctic chars baked for them, and then they have seals, and they do hunt whales sometimes too. So a lot of them, mostly more in the north, they follow their traditional diet, whereas down further close to Yellowknife, a lot of them are, they don't have their traditional diet as much, they follow more of a Western diet. So we see lots of colon cancers. We're seeing a lot of colon cancers in younger patients. Lots of gastric cancers. They're not sure why that is. There's a high incidence of Helicobacter pylori in the north. And there's also, they smoke a lot of their fish too. So whether or not that has a risk factor. And then there's also the genetics that they have looked at. And there's people in the Delta seem to be at increased risk of gastric cancer. But the other thing is a lot of people around the east arm of Slave Lake are quite convinced that it's the Russian satellite. I don't know if you remember, but it was in 2008 or something when a Russian satellite crashed in the Northwest Territories, just around the east arm of Slave Lake, and it contaminated a lot of the area with radioactivity.
Oh, wow. I actually didn't remember that.
Well, it's funny because when it crashed, I think the U.S. president called the Canadian prime minister to inform them that the Russian satellite had crashed in Canada. The Americans were already there.
Well, somebody's got surveillance going on.
Yeah. So they went up and they did have a cleanup, and they charged Russia about $6 million. I think they paid $500,000, but they only got a fraction of the radioactivity. So they're convinced that the caribou and are eating contaminated food, vegetation, and they're shooting at caribou and eating those. So, but they have done studies and haven't really shown an increased correlation.
If these are people living a relatively traditional lifestyle, for want of a better word, do they present much later with cancer? I mean, presumably they're not having any kind of screening. They're not having regular visits with physicians.
No, absolutely. That's a big issue that I deal with. And I think that's one of the most rewarding things is that, you know, when I see these patients, the big thing in healthcare is knowing how to access the system. And as an oncologist, I can get them into the system very quickly and get their treatments going. And then sometimes I see patients who clearly have malignancy, but they don't have any diagnosis. And I think that a lot of these communities, mostly these communities don't have physicians. They have health centers. And there's usually a nurse practitioner at the health center, but they rotate in and out. And they just don't have access to it. So it's kind of sometimes, when they do eventually see the physicians, they'll just come up and talk to me. And I can look at their CT scan or whatever investigations they had. And they say, well, they've got a lung mass. It's probably a lung cancer. And so I can get them down to Edmonton within a week, get a biopsy, and then I can follow up once the biopsy results are available. And so I think that's the biggest access. And it's not uncommon to see patients that have clearly worrisome symptoms for 6 or 7 months, and they're presenting with more advanced disease. And like an example is a young woman in her 30s who presented with rectal bleeding, change in bowel habit, tenesmus, and all the classic symptoms of rectal cancer. And she kept going to the health center and asking, well, I'm worried I might have cancer. And they said, no, you're too young. People your age don't get this type of cancer. And unfortunately, they do. And so she was diagnosed with rectal cancer, and then she already had liver metastases by the time she was diagnosed that were not resectable.
When you see these people, are there cultural issues in terms of how cancer and a terminal disease is communicated that are different than if you're sitting in the clinic in Edmonton?
The biggest difference I find is that, you know, when I see these cancer patients in a terminal, The number one thing I see in these patients is they don't want to die. They want to survive, and they most of them will follow traditional, like our type of medicine too. They do have their traditional medicine. Occasionally, see patients that will follow traditional medicine. They won't take Western medicine, but most of them will take the treatments that you recommend. They usually are pretty good at their follow up and coming for their evaluations. They get very involved in their care, like any other patient, and I think they appreciate the attention they get, and that the fact that if you show that you care about them, you're trying to do the best for them, they're extremely appreciative of what you're doing for them. Occasionally, I have patients that will go with a more traditional lifestyle. I think one of the nicest stories, I think I told you this when we were chatting the other week, but I had an 84-year-old guy who had metastatic rectal cancer, and he had fairly high volume disease, but he was maintaining a relatively good performance status. He was getting out. He has a wood stove in his house, and he would chop his own wood every day, haul it in the house, and his own cooking and things. And he was 84. He had cardiovascular disease, and he had a lot of... I was very hesitant to... I did not want to treat him with chemotherapy. I did not think he would tolerate it well. So I was talking to him about chemotherapy, and I was kind of going over all the bad things that could happen to him. And I said, you know, sometimes, even though you're functioning well when you get chemotherapy, you do compensate. You just don't get that back very quickly at the age of 84. So I was talking to him, and then he didn't speak English. So he had his daughter there as a translator. So she was speaking to him. And then she turned to me and said that my father always believed that the creator created a healing earth. There's all things on this earth that can heal people. So he has decided that he would rather follow a traditional medicine and take spruce gum as a treatment for his cancer. And I remember thinking to myself, that is way better than what I was offer him. So he's still doing well. I saw him not too long ago. Spruce gum's not working. His cancer is growing, but he's still maintaining a good quality of life, and he still wants to follow his traditional medicine. And he told me that his father always told him that the creator gave the white man knowledge about medicine, so you should always listen to the white man. I said, well, it's not just the white man that knows medicine, but and I think those beliefs are very good. And I think he's very spiritual, and I think he's accepted his disease, his prognosis well. And so I think it's always gratifying to hear those stories. And
yeah. I mean, do they have palliative care?
They do. It's a big issue because they, you know, when you're sending somebody back to a community of 300 people, and they don't have a doctor, they have a small health center, usually with one nurse, and they don't have IV drugs there. So arranging palliative care is difficult. But just this morning, and we had a virtual clinic this morning, I was talking to the nurse, and when symptoms get to be unbearable at home, and what they can do is they can transport the patient to Yellowknife, and they have a palliative care facility in Yellowknife. But it's hard because you take patients out of their community, and that's where their family is, all their social structures there. So it's less than ideal, the palliative care.
And you touched on not speaking English. So how many different languages? Is Dene like one language? Do the Inuits have a different language?
They do, yes. They all have their different languages. So I think there's over 20 languages in the Northwest Territories altogether. And so some of them are very widely spoken. Dene is very common. But it depends where you go, what language they speak. But almost all their children speak English. And so it's only the older patients that really don't speak English. And some of them understand a little bit. But I think it's probably with the next generation, I think everybody will understand English. And so I think it'll be easier for the patients to communicate.
Touching on communication, are there cell phones? Is there internet? I mean, are these people, you have to communicate with them in other ways?
Yeah, they all have cell phones. Sometimes it's tragic because sometimes they may have a cell phone, but they don't have money for extra minutes and you can't get a hold of them. So, you know, and that's a gap where I always try to get the social worker to see if they can get some funding for their cell phone, but we've been unsuccessful at that. They have internet available to them. So the internet goes all over the Arctic. But communication sometimes can be a problem. So if they run out of minutes on their phone and we can't get I've gotten sometimes like 2 or 3 months and nobody can find the patient. And I get kind of frustrated because I said to my nurse, I said, like, seriously, I said, there's like 1,000 people living in Kluktuk. I said, there's no road in, there's no road out. I said, where could they be?
No. Hiding in someone's basement.
Everybody knows everybody. And I said, all you have to do is call the health center. And the health center could walk over their house and get that patient for us and bring them to the health center. And that's how we got a hold of her. Then the patient came down. They said they only live like a block from the health center. So for like 2 months, they were trying to get a hold of this patient. And of course, then they brought it to my attention. They can't get a hold of her for surgery. So it's just like, it shouldn't be hard to find somebody.
I mean, you've walked in the shoes, having had your own cancer diagnosis and your own chemotherapy. Have you walked in the shoes in the sense that you've been up to these, you know, Inuit communities or the, what was our politically correct term for what we would call Native Americans here?
So Indigenous now.
I think the term changed over the years, didn't it?
Yeah, way back they were called Indians because, of course, when Columbus came, they thought they were from India. They're called Indians, and then they were called Aboriginals, and they changed to the First Nations. The First Nation is still appropriate, and then the other term now is just the Indigenous people.
And the Indigenous people are different from the Inuits.
So there's the Indigenous include the Inuit and the what we used to call the Indians. So they're all from the same people. So they all came over the Kamchatka Peninsula and went into the Arctic, Alaska, then came down and eventually spread into the Americas. Both of the Americas. So genetically, they're similar, but they are a little different. And so I think you can see the physical characteristics are a little different between the two. So I think the Inuit tend to be quite a bit smaller because their diet is different. It's a lot of seal, fish, and so they tend to be smaller. Whereas the Indigenous people that went onto the plains, they had a very high meat diet and they tend to be taller and a bit heavier. So,
and we talked about, you know, different cancer instances. Are there other health issues which are more prominent in either the Inuits or the Dene?
Yeah. So I think that when they adopt a Western diet, that's tragic. There's a very high incidence of type 2 diabetes and obesity. There's one community around, I think it's Sandy Lake in Saskatchewan, where it's 100% type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
So probably well over half my patients are obese, type 2 diabetics, and so it's a very high instance of diabetes.
What about substance abuse? Do they get access to tobacco, alcohol?
Yep. So they're almost all smokers. So I think that they usually start smoking around the age of 12 or 13. And it tends to be the smaller the community, the more they smoke. And then alcohol, a lot of the reserves have restrictions on alcohol. So they're only allowed to bring, if they come from the South, they're only allowed to bring, I think, 1 40-ouncer back with them. But people smuggle it in. And if they become alcoholics or they're drinking heavily, they can get kicked out of the community. So they usually end up in Yellowknife, sadly, on the streets. And then they often, you know, they live in the homeless shelters, or else they set up encampments or stuff. So it's kind of sad. And same with drug abuse. There's a lot of drugs in the communities. Some people have horrible abuse issues. You know, I talked to one of the elders and he was complaining about all the drug use and stuff. And like they had like 3 deaths the week before from drug overdoses. And I said, well, it must be fairly easily control the influx of drugs because there's no roads, no into the community. I said, everybody has to fly. And I said, do you think you could get sniffer dogs or something to check when people get off the planes? But he just said they know who the drug dealers are, and they just, you know, but unfortunately drug abuse is rapid and suicides are at a much higher instance there too.
I imagine you touched on this where we spoke before. Suicide's also related to sunlight exposure, and some of your patients, at least in the winter, are seeing very little sunlight, aren't they?
Yeah, I think for them it's more sort of just abuse issues, the suicide issues, and just a lack of just sort of a hopelessness. I mean, they're in small communities. I think they, you know, I don't think there's a lot for them to do other than in the wintertime. I think a lot of people, they don't go outside too much. They spend, so I asked them, I said, what do you do when it's minus 40? And they said, just stay in the house. And the housing is not great. They can have a very small house of like 900 square feet, and there can be like 15 people living in the house or 12 people. So it's often it could be three generations, often the grandmother, the children, and then the grandchildren live in the same place. So housing is definitely overcrowded, you know, so I think there's a lot of social issues that need to be dealt with. But I think overall, especially the Inuit, they seem to be very happy people. Like they're always smiling when they come down. They just they have a very good outlook on life. They tell me, I have one patient, and I told my nurse we can never discharge her. She has a surveillance now for colorectal cancer. I said, she just makes my day. I said, she comes in. some people suck the life out of you. It's not nice to say, but some just take a lot of emotional support and they just drain you. I said, but this patient comes in and I said, she just picks you up and she gives you reason to exist. And it's like, she's always happy and she's always so thankful for everybody. And I'm so happy with my life. And so she's really nice, but a lot of them are very happy.
I love that. I think you told me they sometimes bring you gifts.
Sometimes they do, not so often. But sometimes they bring not gifts so much, but when they come down to Yellowknife, they'll sometimes bring a char, which is of course my favorite fish. And they'll bring a whole char that's frozen, and they just ask if anybody wants to buy a fish. And they know I want to buy it, right? So I feel a little bit guilty about buying it, but they clearly want to sell it to me because they push it, and then. So I said, well, I'll buy it from you. They said, how much do you want for it? And they said, $30. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty good deal for a whole char.
It's funny because it's not a gift. It's an opportunity to trade with the white doctor.
Yeah, yeah. And quite often it'll come down to, not so much, but when I go, there's a place that's known for, they've got local whitefish and they do fish and chips. I'll go over there, and quite often, like the Inuit, when they're down for medical reasons or something, they'll come through it's a little bar area where I go to eat, and they'll come through and they'll sell sealskin gloves or something. And they're just trying to make a little bit of money before they go back. And
is their travel paid for? I mean, if they're, they're flying down. Well, actually, how do they get from their community even to Yellowknife? Is there are airports that are in these communities?
There is. And so that's the only transportation in and out during the, summer and winter. And so medical travel is all covered. And that's one of the biggest expenses of healthcare in the Northwest Territories is medical travel. Because if you're coming from Pawlatuck or Cambridge Bay, it's probably 6 hours to Yellowknife. And then you have to go to Edmonton, it's another couple hours. So all their medical travel is covered. Almost everybody gets an escort. And so when they get to Yellowknife, for example, when they come to Edmonton, there's a place called Larga House that's run by the Northwest Territories. And they bought an old hotel just out by the airport. And it's actually quite nice. And so patients are picked up at the airport. They have a van that picks them up, and then they take them to Larga House. And then they have traditional food there. They can all stay in Larga House. And then they drive them to all their appointments, and then they drive them back to Larga House. And then when they fly back, they take them back to the airport, and they head back to their communities.
So looking back and looking forward, with your expanded role there in these communities, what have you gained from it?
I think I've gained a lot of personal growth and experience from it, because I'm learning the Indigenous culture and their lifestyle. I think that I've gained a tremendous respect for it. They live very much in sync with the environment. I think that you feel like you truly make a difference in these patients, because they don't have a good access to medical specialists. So I think when you can intervene and try to make their journey a little bit easier, I think that's very rewarding. And the patients, they always show you how much they appreciate it. And I think that it is very rewarding as an oncologist, because you really do that feel like you make a difference in these patients' lives.
I think that's a wonderful note to end on. I think what you're doing is incredible. And I imagine this community just, would be lost without you. But are you a one-man band, or do you have
pretty much
reinforcements?
So I did it with my department director. We were kind of doing a tag team initially when it started. And then he became our department director a couple of years ago. So he informed me that he had to give it up. So I took it on by myself. And so in September, we did our very first cancer update for the Northwest Territories. We had 37 people attend, which is good for up there. And I brought four of my colleagues from Edmonton. They went up, they all gave a talk, and it was really well received. And so we're going to do that now as an annual event. And then, so I think Most of people that I bring up to the Northwest Territories absolutely love it there. But next year we'll do a fishing trip. So
there we go. I want to throw my hat into the ring to be a sure. up there sometime.
I'd love to have you come up. When my kids were little and I first started going up there, I went on a Friday and I'd go up to work Friday. It takes my kids, my youngest son, I think Michael was 4 or 5 when I first took him. And my daughter, my third daughter, just loved it. And I would take one kid at a time. And then we'd go fishing to this place called Blatchford. And so we'd take a little float plane off. There's an old town, which is right down by the lake. And there's a big float plane dock there. So we would go down to Artindi. We'd get on a float plane at 5 o'clock. And they would take off from the lake. And then we'd fly about 40 minutes and we'd land on a different lake. And there's a beautiful lodge built up on the hill. And it was just like it had all the modern conveniences and food was amazing. And at nighttime after supper, when it got dark, we'd go out and sit out on the rocks and we should take a beer out with us. Not my kids, of course, but go and just watch the northern lights. The entire sky would light up in greens and reds, and it was amazing.
That's amazing. Mike, yeah. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Camidge. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at DR Camidge on X for additional commentary.